Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, supported by DownloadTennis.com. On today's Wimbledon Round 3 catch-up,
Raducanu's Cinderella story continues,
Federer stops a Norrie fight back,
and Daniil Medvedev battles back from the brink to beat Cilic.
Kim is on holiday this weekend. Lee has stepped in again. Lee, at Tennis on Telly, thank you so much for filling in. It's a pleasure to have you back. I know you've got some big, big things to talk about for round three. It's been an exciting last couple of days, particularly, I think, for British fans. It may have started, I think, on a downer, particularly in the men's side with, you know, Andy Murray and Dan Evans and Cam Norrie yesterday all going out. But we have had a ray of light, and that ray of light has been Emma Raducanu.
It really has. I've been really impressed with what I've seen from Emma Raducanu. You know, honestly, you couldn't ask for a better story at Wimbledon, could you, than a British player, from a British perspective. You couldn't ask for a better story than a British player reaching the last 16 at Wimbledon. Especially one that many people probably haven't heard of before. You know, she hasn't played on the tour until this year. She played at a match in Nottingham, her first ever WTA match on the tour. But she has been, obviously, the right people are looking at her and seeing that, you know, she's got talent, and rewarding her for that and giving her a wild card.
She's still doing her A levels, which is mad, which is one of the reasons I think why she's not, you know, maybe as many people don't realize that she's a big prospect for, you know, for the women's game, because we've not seen her at many tournaments, and the tournaments she has playing have been these sort of lower profile, you know, domestic tournaments in the UK. But, you know, this Wimbledon has really, I think, has been a game changer. She's into the fourth round. She beat Sorana Castella 6-3, 7-5. Castella last round, I watched it, beat Azarenka. And she, you know, she came into the tournament, I don't think, with the best results on grass. I don't think it's her most natural surface. But, you know, she's been around the tour a lot. She's got a lot of experience. And with the confidence of a big win like that against, you know, one of the big seeds in Azarenka, you know, I think many people were expecting her to come out as the victor, but Raducanu just was having none of that. She wasn't overawed by the occasion, you know, being put on number one court and, you know, coming up against someone, you know, with the quality of Castella. It was just such a breath of fresh air.
Well, I think she'd sort of proved herself that she could do that already, hadn't she, with her first round and her second round wins. I mean, to beat Vondrousova is quite an achievement. You know, she reached the final at Roland Garros. So I think she's proved that she's up there at that level. Obviously, she hasn't got the ranking to match that yet. But I think we're at a time at the moment where rankings are a little bit, well, are they? You know, they're not really, can't really read too much into rankings at the moment, because they don't make any sense, because we've had the special rankings for the pandemic and everything. What it will do to her ranking is she becomes the new British number four now. She's overtaken Katie Bolter. She'll be around 175 in the rankings. That's, you know, that's going to get her into some decent level events. That's going to get her playing on the tour, probably qualifying at the bigger level events, and probably direct entry into perhaps 250s, and especially 125s and some of the high level ITFs that she'll probably still want to play, because I think to throw herself into that, you know, into that arena with with the big players all of the time might be a little bit too much for her, and she'll probably want to make sure that she sort of maintains that ranking. She's also going to be wary that if she gets good ranking points now, they're going to drop off in a year. So she's going to want to back up her progress here with something, you know, to keep her consistent. But, you know, another win would put her around 130. I'm not saying that, you know, she can do it, but there's a chance. She's got Tom Lanovic, so, you know, it's not a bad chance, is it?
No,
so,
yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. just talking about the match in itself, you know, as I said, 6-3, 7-5, straight sets. It was very nervy, I think, towards the, you know, the back end of that second set. There were lots of breakpoint chances, a lot of deuce games, particularly, I think, on the Castella serve. And I was sort of a bit nervous about, you know, as those breakpoints came and went, I was sort of like, oh, was that Raducanu's moment? But she didn't blink. And I think that was what was really, really impressive, given that, you know, she's still very early on in her tennis career. She's only 18 years old. I think she's the youngest British woman to reach the round of 16 at Wimbledon in the Open era. So to kind of, you know, just kind of, I think, just move on and sort of forget about those breakpoint chances and just back yourself that, you know, another one is going to come along. I think it was really, really impressive. And I think what she showed to me on the court was, you know, her movement and her shot making. There were lots of like little angled shots that I think Castella found kind of difficult, I think, to deal with. And she, you know, I think she exploited, I think, arguably, I think Castella's biggest weakness, which was her movement around the court. You could just see it was just a little bit uncomfortable, I think, from, you know, moving from left to right. So I think that was one of the things that Raducanu did very well.
Oh yeah, definitely. She, you know, some of the accuracy on the angles that she was making, she was getting those balls right across the court and right into the corners where she needs to make those winners. Some of that was breathtaking to watch. I was really, really impressed with that.
I think the commentator was, the commentary team, I think they were almost surprised that she was being able to make these shots. You know, she was just playing very inspired tennis and showing us a level, I think, that, you know, we've not seen, or certainly not seen, I think, on a stage like this before. And yeah, really kind of the, you know, the sky's the limit at the moment. And it definitely feels very much like, you know, Coco Gauff's story, I think, breakout story of the time. And it feels like this is now, I don't know about you, Lee, but for me, this feels like the Coco Gauff story for British fans.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Coco Gauff, because Coco Gauff, I think, if we go back to 2 years ago, where sort of Coco Gauff was going through that journey, she was obviously 3 years younger than Emma Raducanu is now. There was a lot more pressure, I think, on Coco Gauff than there is on Emma Raducanu now. I think Coco Gauff's come through that and, she's dealt with that very well. I mean, I thought personally Coco Gauff might be what I call a one slam wonder, 2 years ago, but she hasn't actually really gone away. You know, I thought she'd probably, you know, she'd have a tournament where she does really well. She'd go away a little bit. She'd drop down a bit for a couple of years, still play, but obviously, but not be like, you know, high up on people's radars, and then make a proper comeback and then, you know, when she was a bit older. But she's been quite consistent. You know, she's equaled that run that she had in 2019 so far this year, at Wimbledon. She reached the quarterfinals at Roland Garros. I didn't watch her singles match, but I watched her doubles on Friday, and she looked like she was having fun while she was playing as well, which I think always helps. You know, I don't think she's feeling that pressure. I think with Emma Raducanu, I think, you know, I don't think the pressure's been quite as much as it was on Coco Gauff 2 years ago. I don't know whether that's because she's doing this in the bubble, so therefore there's not all of the outside pressure. She's only got the people really that she's with. I think she probably doesn't pay attention. Emma Raducanu probably doesn't pay attention to the media. She probably, you know, I've seen her on Instagram, but she's not like, I don't think she's doing that all of the time. She's, you know, it's not like straight after the match and she's not reading comments. And I don't think she's, you know, I think she's spending the time with her team first, you know, talking about, you know, her game and putting that first, which is probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it was quite funny to hear, I think, Raducanu say, she, you know, what are you going to do now that there's going to be so much hype on you going into the, you know, the second week? And she said, oh, I'll just hand my phone to my osteo and they can take care of it. So yeah, I think she's going to do really well, I think, not to kind of, believe the hype, but it's hard not to, isn't it? She's just kind of played, she's kind of come out of nowhere. I think she was the lowest ranked player in the draw and into the second week. It really is a remarkable run. And as you said, I think it is a situation where rankings really at the moment, I mean, we've said this before, I think, on the podcast, like rankings really have gone out the window at the moment because of the pandemic. And although she was the lowest ranked player in the draw, she's certainly not playing the tennis of that level. And, you know, to see her, I think, particularly, you know, with the way, you know, she, her manner on court, her presence, particularly, I think, in that post-match kind of interview on court, she definitely has a maturity that goes beyond her years. And I think she was like almost kind of like ready for this moment, and she's, you know, taking it by the horns.
I did wonder if perhaps we might have had a similar story with Jack Draper had he had a better draw and not faced Djokovic in the first round. I think, you know, he did really well to take a set off Novak Djokovic in that first round match, and he'd really, you know, he sort of announced himself at Queen's and has played really well as well. Unfortunately, the draw's not been very kind to him, but I do wonder if there might have been a similar story there had that draw been kinder to Jack Draper. I mean, he'll be someone who we will see.
He's still the only person to take a set off
exactly so far. And he was also the lowest ranked male player in the draw as well. So that, you know, there's a parallel there with Emma Raducanu in terms of, you know, their background. They've not really played at those tour level events. I think it's a very similar story. Like during the pandemic, they didn't really play many events, played some, you know, events that didn't attract ranking points, but were good for earning some money, so that they could go out and then play events, you know, into next year and the year after, which is what was the purpose of those events, like the Progress Tour and the Pro League that went on. You know, Emma Raducanu won the Pro League, the one that ended at the end of 2020. So I think, you know, the people at the LTA certainly saw enough to put her forward for a wild card. I did read that they'd actually asked for a main draw wild card, but the All England Club had turned it down and put it as a qualifying wild card, and then saw her play in the Nottingham ITF the second week at Nottingham and changed their minds and upgraded it for her. So, you know, aren't we glad that they did? You know, it would have been a big mistake had they not done, if she'd had to come through qualifying as well. I'm not sure, you know.
You just never know, do you?
Yeah, exactly. So, really impressed. We touched on Coco Gauff a little bit. She won 6-3, 6-3, beat Kaja Juvan of Slovenia, 65 minutes. So that's, you know, quite a decent, solid win for her. I did, like I say, I didn't watch the singles match. I don't know if you had any thoughts on how she'd played in that match.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, Coco Gauff, another teenager who is doing really well. She had a really, really, really solid season. She reached the quarterfinals for the first time at a Grand Slam last month at Roland Garros. And she's just kind of continuing that and continuing her development, which I think we'll always kind of obviously associate her with that, you know, that breakthrough at Wimbledon as a 15-year-old qualifier. But again, to see that, I think, development this season at SW19 has been very, very impressive. And although I think, you know, she's been faced caliber of opponents that, yes, she would be expected to beat, she's just going through the rounds quite easily, no fuss. And again, it's been very slick and mature. And it was interesting to hear her talk about her serve being one of the reasons, I think, that she's been playing kind of so well. And you know, she just I think he's going to be a threat kind of going into the second week. I don't necessarily think she's had a test yet, and maybe kind of going into the second week, you know, there are certainly going to be kind of sterner tests coming. But I certainly think that Coco Gauff, kind of this tournament has shown how much she has developed from that, you know, 15-year-old kind of qualifier story we had, you know, a few seasons ago.
Yeah, it's interesting. They always seem to put her on centre court as well, which kind of, to me, in my head, thinks that's adding pressure onto her, but she seems to handle it quite well. But I do wonder if, actually, is it right that she always gets a match on centre court?
I'm interested by that one because, yeah, I've seen this as well. You know, all of her, I think, matches, a lot of her matches, yeah, have been on the show courts on number one and centre. I don't know if tournament organisers are seeing her as like, who's going to fill the Serena Williams void? You know, we need some big names being put on kind of the show courts, particularly on the women's side, with big players going out like, you know, Serena Williams, Venus Williams, Azarenka. Mm. And I certainly think, you know, this tournament, because those big names have gone out early, I certainly think that the rationale for putting players like Coco Gauff on, I think, is to get people known to these kind of personalities who they might have heard a bit more about, you know, in the build up or the previous seasons based on her story so far.
Yeah, and I think there's an added element to playing on centre court is that you get the TV coverage and you get all of the stuff that goes around the TV coverage in terms of the interviews and the features and that. And that can be a lot of media pressure. I think they've done the right thing with Emma Raducanu. They've not put her on centre court every day. I don't think she, you know, centre court and number one court are very similar. So I don't think that, honestly, there's really much in that, and she has played on number one court now, but I think that, you know, she's not been sort of thrown in at the deep end. But I did wonder about centre court assignments, particularly, you know, when you look at, normally you see former champions get put on centre court as well, because they're people that people have heard of, like Venus Williams. I know Kim has expressed her opinion on this earlier in the week, that she didn't necessarily think that Venus had perhaps earned, perhaps that's a bit harsh saying using that word, but perhaps not been worthy of being put on centre court this year because she's so low ranked. But you look at someone like Angie Kerber, she is a former champion. She's seeded at this tournament, yet she hasn't played on centre court yet, although she did play her first round match on court number one. You know, it kind of feels like she's now only going to play her next match on centre court because she's going to play Coco Gauff, and they're putting that match on centre court for Coco and not for Kerber. Do you feel that way? Or
I mean, let's talk about the kind of two, I mean, there's two kind of former Grand Slam champions you know, in the draw on court yesterday, in Angie Kerber but also Yelena Ostapenko. Let's start with Kerber, because she came through a bit of a topsy-turvy match against Saznovic, 2-6, 6-love, 6-1. I think there are always going to be questions about, you know, she had that absolute mammoth match against Sara Cerebes-Tormo in the previous round. So it was great, I think, to see her come through another sort of three-set match. And I think, again, it was maybe she had to find a little bit of time to, you know, find her range against Saznovic. But yeah, it was a very good performance, I think, if you just got to discount that first set. But yeah, I do agree. I do think she's kind of going under the radar a bit in terms of, yeah, she is a former champion. I think, you know, a lot of people forget she beat, you know, Serena Williams in a Grand Slam final, which is no mean feat. But I certainly think that she's flying under the radar, even, which sort of seems silly because, you know, she is the Bad Homburg champion. You know, she's got form. She is peaking at the right time. But I certainly actually think that playing on more on these outside courts and, you know, being with the fans in close proximity, I think has sort of helped her. And, you know, yes, we didn't get the Kerber Serena Williams match that, you know, people had earmarked kind of for round three, but I think Kerber's making the most of it.
Yeah, definitely. I switched onto that match, or rather I was watching the sort of the build up on the BBC, and then they went to that match and she was 5-1 down in the first set. Mm. And I thought, yikes, that's not good. It's all going the wrong way. And then the rain came. So, I literally saw 1 point of that first set, because of that. But yeah, I think the rain delay helped her because she came back and although she eventually did lose that first set, I think she'd probably got, during that rain delay, she probably thought, right off the first set and then concentrate on, you know, because to come back from 5-1 down is a tougher ask, probably.
It was a very fast start, wasn't it, from Saznovic? I think she hit like 15 winners. Yeah. It was a fast start. And maybe it caught Kerber cold a little bit.
I think so.
So, you know, the fact that she was able, I think, you know, she's a Grand Slam champion. You know, she knows what it has, you know, she knows what it has to take. And putting all that effort in against Cerebus Tormo in the round before, she wouldn't have wanted to go out in straights to Sasnovich. And yeah, I agree. I think that rain delay sort of helped her. I think maybe even come up with a different strategy, a plan B that she was able to execute, and Sasnovich didn't really have an answer to it.
Yeah, well, Kerber may have extended her winning streak from a title before Wimbledon, but the champion in Eastbourne, Ostapenko, has seen hers come to an end.
Oh my god, yeah. This match, Lee. Oh my god,
I feel like so much drama. I feel like the tennis was a bit of a sideshow from what was going on in the actual match. I mean, just to sum up what happened, Ostapenko took a medical timeout. She was down love 4 in the third set, and Ayla Tomljanovic accused her of faking the medical timeout, which, you know, I think players have done in the past, because they've got themselves into that position where they thought, I need a break. The only way I'm going to get a break and sort myself out is to get a medical timeout. Not pointing any fingers at anyone in particular. But players have done it in the past. We know that. But yeah, so then there was all sorts of beef at the end of the match with the handshake or not handshake and just, you know, calling out at each other across. And then it carried on in the press conferences,
it did let
accusing
up, did it?
Each other of being disrespectful to each other. And, oh, my God, yeah. So the actual tennis itself is forgotten about. It's all about what happened, you know, the verbals, I think, was, yeah. But, I mean, her serve was almost non-existent in the third set, Ostapenko. So I think, you know, that leads me to think that perhaps there was a niggle of some kind or an injury. I'd, you know, give her the benefit of the doubt with that one, because
you're giving her the benefit of the doubt. I'm absolutely not giving her the benefit of the doubt. I think, you know, just watching it on TV and watching the highlights afterwards, I have to say fair play to Ayla Tomljanovic, because she called it out on court, and I sort of agree with her. You know, her opponent Ostapenko was 4 love down. She was looking for something to, I think, disrupt Tomljanovic. You know, a player who is not very good at closing out big matches. We saw that at, you know, the Australian Open against Simona Halep. I think she was 5-2 up in the third set. And I think, you know, I think Ostapenko knew that. And she just thought, if I can get into her head somehow, then maybe, you know, we could have another Simona Halep situation on our hands. And that's why I think she maybe kind of called for that medical timeout. And I've got to say, I think I just think the WTA and or the ATP as well, they just need to clamp down on this. It's getting a bit silly. We've seen these tactical timeouts at play before. It's happened once again.
Oh, yeah, it definitely happens.
And I'm just a bit like, you know, to Tomljanovic's point, Ostapenko having an abdominal acute injury after playing an hour 30 minutes of tennis, all of a sudden, it just felt a bit too good to be true.
Well, I did wonder what was the reason for Ostapenko being love 4 down in that third set. Was that because there was a niggle, or was that literally just because she was playing bad and Tomljanovic was playing better than her?
I mean, fair play. She did have a long match, I think, against Kasatkina in the round before. So, you know, maybe there was some, you know, hangover from that in terms of her body, but I've got to be siding with Tomljanovic on this. And you know, she, I think, is a consummate kind of professional. You know, she said in her, you know, press conference afterwards that, you know, regardless of all the drama that happened, you know, her feelings towards winning exceeded that. So, you know, I'm really happy for her, because as I said, she is a player, I think, who's got tremendous capability on a tennis court, tremendous talent, but has not necessarily been able to close those big matches. And, you know, maybe the tide has turned kind of with this performance, because it certainly was topsy-turvy. It certainly was, you know, a battle. But to see kind of Tomljanovic come through to the second week was really impressive. And, you know, I think she spoke about, you know, the fact that, you know, she's 27 now, and she, I think, over kind of lockdown was reflecting on, you know, what are her achievements so far. And she's like, when is my moment going to happen? And, you know, I think certainly, you know, the fact that she's got You know, the fact that she's got, is it Kerber in the next round?
No, Tom Lanovic. She's got Emma Raducanu in the next round.
The fact that she's got Raducanu in the next round. She, yeah. You know, all the non-British fans will be looking at and thinking, you know, that's a big opportunity for Tom Janovic to make a quarterfinal.
Let's talk about the men, because we've not talked about them yet. We need to talk about Cam Norrie, I think. The last British hope in the men's draw, lost to Roger Federer. Personally, I don't think that was unexpected. I think, you know, Cam Norrie is a good player on his day, but Federer is a very good player on his day. So, how do you think, I'm interested to hear how you thought Federer played. And then me being a Cam Norrie fan, I'll talk about how I felt Cam Norrie played.
You know, with this match, you know, I think Federer, again, I think, you know, he had that, I think he was able to really kind of rediscover his mojo against Gasquet in the second round. And I think he kind of continued that on. It looked a lot better, hit 48 winners. You know, I was sort of wondering, because I actually felt Norrie's game is a little bit similar to Mannarino in the first round, in the sense that it's quite flat, it's quite low. Yes, maybe Norrie doesn't have the variety that maybe hindered him against someone like Federer. But I wondered, you know, the way that Mannarino was able to be awkward, you know, with his gameplay, whether Norrie could also be as awkward given their kind of similar styles. And I sort of felt that Norrie was sort of threatening to do the unthinkable and maybe take it to a fifth set. And I think you can tell by the, you know, the expressions afterwards from Federer, you know, he said, "I'm super relieved as it was a tough battle." You can tell that, you know, he sensed there was a momentum shift brewing, but he was very happy, I think, to be able to nip it in the bud.
I think on Cam Norrie's point of view, I think he was very nervous going into that match, and that really showed in you know, throughout probably most of the first set. I think had he come on to...
Was it his first match on centre court?
I don't think he has played on centre court before. I know he's certainly not played Norrie on centre court. Sorry, he's certainly not played Federer on centre court before. He's only played Federer before the Hopman Cup. But I don't think Norrie has had inexperience on that big stage, because he's played Nadal on Châtrier this year. So, you know, it's a very similar experience playing on the big stage. But I did think that he came into that with, you know, the weight of the own, you know, the last British person in the draw. You know, some people have had some small doubts about Roger Federer and how far he could go, and therefore was there that a bit more pressure on him to do well and to sort of make a statement. And I think he just came in full bag of nerves at the beginning. And had that not been the case, had this been, you know, on court 12 or 18 or at a different event, it might have been a different story, you know, had there not been that pressure. But it did find his rhythm eventually, but I think it was just too late. I think, you know, he probably would have done better to not have those nerves at the beginning and play, you know, perhaps that would have then, you know, been, you know, perhaps one set each at one point rather than being two sets down. I don't know.
Yeah, you felt that second set was quite pivotal. And, you know, I think, you know, with Norrie, he's done as well as he probably could have, you know, looking at the draw, Federer in the third round, taking him to four sets. Yeah, pretty good account of himself. Again, it will be a case of, I think, just continuing to eat up the, you know, eat up the wins on the ATP tour and just kind of continue that consistency across the whole season.
I don't think his first title is very far away, to be honest, Norrie. He's not going to play the Olympics, and he's going to go and play Los Cabos next. He loves it in the heat in Mexico, and he loves playing. I think he's going to play Atlanta and then, you know, prepare for the US Open. That is the stage that he really suits his game and he likes playing on. So I think that's, you know, why he's not going to go to the Olympics. He's going to concentrate on that. And I'm hopeful that, you know, he will have a good run there. just to mention that he won in the doubles with his partner Munar, and they knocked out the fifth seed. So it's not all bad for Cam Norrie. And that was on the night after the loss to Federer. So, you know, and I could tell that he really enjoyed that, and he really put a lot into that. So I don't think he's the kind of person who sees that loss of Federer as, okay, that's a real, you know, I don't think he sees that as a real downer. He'll see that he took a set off him, and he'll probably, you know, have analysed it in the same way that we have, that could have gone in there without the nerves, and perhaps, you know, but he'll know that. And I think he's very honest to himself about his play. So, yeah.
And we had two other sort of dramatic matches for different reasons. We had Medvedev versus Cilic, with Medvedev winning from two sets to love down, which I think was the first time he's achieved that. And then we also had Nick Kyrgios against Felix Auger-Aliassime, which ended in retirement. Kyrgios had to leave. He had an abdominal injury at one set all. Let's quickly touch on the Medvedev match, I think, first of all, because, again, this was a first for Medvedev. He was, you know, 6-7, 3-6 down against Cilic, who I think is like 9-1 win-loss record on grass courts this season. That, to come back from that against a player of Cilic's caliber, I think was very, very impressive. You can't, you know, he won those final three sets very, you know, formulaically, which, you know, very pragmatically, 6-3, 6-3, 6-2. But I think Medvedev will have, you know, even greater confidence now, the fact that he's gone to the, you know, he's gone to a five set. He's got a five set win, but the fact that he was two sets down to do that was very, very impressive.
Yeah, I think that'll do a lot for his confidence, knowing that you can win a match from two sets down. I did look at this one in the draw before it happened, and I think that's got a potential for being five sets, but I didn't think it would be two sets down and a comeback. I thought it would be more evenly matched throughout. So that surprised me. I did tip Medvedev to win that one. Pretty much, you know, based on Medvedev being the higher ranked player. But yeah, it's, I mean, Cilic has got form for this, having led two sets and then lost in five. I think, you know, over the last few years, he lost to Federer that way. He's lost to Payer that way. You know, it's not, and it's
you've always got a chance.
Yeah, but also I think it's going to probably be a real knock to his confidence. I mean, you know, Cilic, he's getting on a bit now, isn't he? He's been around for donkey's years, but it's probably still going to be a knock to his confidence to be two sets up, and then, you know, something in the match changes, whether it's himself or whether it's the opponent, that switches it around and it doesn't. Is that because he's playing now at a level that is not suited to five set matches, and that, you know, that's perhaps pushing it a bit too far for him now? I don't know.
Yeah, it felt a little bit, you know, I think on a smaller scale to, you know, when Roger Federer played Pete Sampras all those years ago. I think it was felt maybe like a passing of the torch moment, maybe like on a smaller scale, yeah. Because Cilic is one of those players who, you know, has given us fantastic memories, you know, at Wimbledon over the years. But coming up against one of the new guys, Medvedev, who again has a game that is very, I think, well suited to a grass court, and was able to find a way to kind of get it done. Another player who also has a game for a grass court with his big serve is Nick Kyrgios. And unfortunately, he had to retire at one set all against Felix Auger-Aliassime. You could tell, I think, Kyrgios was hampered, particularly in that second set, with regards to his serve, which is probably his most potent weapon, let's be honest. A bit, you know, obviously for fans, a bit disappointing. I think everyone was sort of circling that match as one that could be a real epic. But it was, I think, unfortunate for Nick Kyrgios. I think, though, we've got to be realistic here. His body kind of let him down, and I think it probably showed him, or made him realise, that if he wants to kind of compete on the tour regularly, you know, he's going to need to take care of his body. He can't just, you know, turning up and doing your thing is only going to help you so many times. And yes, that helped him in round one. Yes, that helped him in round two. But at some point, it felt that, yeah, his body was maybe going to give, and it did against Auger-Aliassime.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was really struggling to serve, wasn't he? And if there's no point carrying on if it's only going to make the pain and worse as well. But there was a funny moment in that match. Well, there was two funny moments in that match. Well, one at the very start of the match, Kyrgios forgot his shoes. I mean, how do you start a tennis match and forget to bring on your shoes? And the referee had to come out and bring the shoes on for him at the start of the match. I don't understand how that happens, but obviously in the mind of Nick Kyrgios, what is going on for that to happen?
And Lee, I was almost expecting him to, I wouldn't have put it past Nick Kyrgios if he wasn't able to serve properly. I would have expected him just to go underarm serve like every point, but it didn't come to that. But it was a bit of a shame. You know, FAA I think would be very happy that he wasn't kind of tested, I think, to the full, because you know he is again one of these players who's just kind of coming through. He's riding on a wave of confidence, you know, with that final in Stuttgart. You know, getting to the semi-finals in Halle, just continuing his form, and it's got a lot better, I think, since the clay season, which wasn't particularly good. Went out early, you know, in Roland Garros, but it feels like the grass has really kind of, I think, rejuvenated his season.
The other moment in that match was Kyrgios pretty much trolled Felix into challenging. He told him to challenge, and he did, and it was a bad challenge. And obviously, he lost a challenge for that. I mean, you know, I think you talked about it in the last pod with Kim when you were previewing this match. You said all Felix needs to do is just completely ignore what was going on the other end of the court,
and he didn't.
And he took the bait and fell through.
You love to see it as a fan. You love to see it. But yeah, Oceania team did get sold down a river there, didn't they? Yeah. The whole play. We also, very quickly before we just kind of go to an ad break, we did have straight sets wins for Ilya Vashka, Matteo Berrettini, Lorenzo Sonego and Hubert Hurkacz. Quite impressive. Italy, you know, Sonego, I described him, Lee, as Bambi on ice when I saw him at Queen's. So for him to get to the second week on a surface that I was expecting... I think he's done a lot better here than he did at, I think in the French Open, he went out in the first round to Lloyd Harris. So for him to do much better on the grass is sort of surprising. But yeah, again, Italian tennis doing very, very well for themselves.
And Sonego's got Federer next, so.
Oh, yeah. That should be a walk in the park.
Yeah. And just a word on Hubert Hurkacz. He's the only player who hasn't dropped his serve yet. So far this Wimbledon, so he's into the fourth round, hasn't dropped his serve so far, which is, I think, is quite an achievement. So
a very dangerous player. I think he was on a bit of a losing streak going into Wimbledon, so he's definitely going to be a dangerous player to watch. But listeners, we're going to be taking a quick break now. I hope you can join us in the second half, where we are going to be looking back on all the results from day five, including Andy Murray and Dan Evans. So don't go anywhere. This episode of The Passing Shot is sponsored by Manscaped, the best in men's below-the-waist grooming, to ensure you can always have new balls, please.
And just in time for the grass court season, Manscaped have launched their fourth generation trimmer, the appropriately titled Lawnmower 4.0.
Over lockdown, tending to my nether regions has become an important routine, including the all-important issue of ball trimming. I love the lawnmower's smooth, comfortable grooming experience that gives me next-level attention to detail.
And it makes an excellent gift for a male partner, friend or family member who maybe has a bit too much ball fuzz down there. So the Lawnmower 4.0 will serve up a right treat.
Use Manscaped now with our exclusive code PSPOD20 to get 20% off and free worldwide shipping at manscaped.com. That's PSPOD20. Links in the description. Your balls will thank you. This is The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim. Joel and Lee, supported by downloadtennis.com. And now we are going to move on and look back on day five. And Lee, I think we're going to have to start on... For British fans, on a bit of a downer, we've got to talk about Andy Murray and Dan Evans on Friday, both on centre court, both unfortunately losing. I think, you know, let's start with the Andy Murray match. He came up against Denis Shapovalov. I mean, he lost 6-4, 6-2, 6-2. Let's be honest, it was a bit of a thumping. He wasn't quite able to get it together You know, there was no heroics as much as I think Sue Barker on the BBC was hoping it was going to be a thriller. But yeah, Shapovalov was very, very, very professional. He got on court. He knew what he wanted to do. And I, you know, as much as Andy Murray wasn't able to play his game, I don't think Shapovalov let him.
No, definitely. I mean, I kind of expected this. I think Andy Murray is still, I don't think he's reached the sort of the peak of this sort of comeback. But I think he's still finding his feet a little bit. I don't think he's quite got the match. You know, he said himself he needs to play matches to play better. And I think he's still working towards that aim of where he wants to be. But, and you know, I think he was quite down after this match, but he has said generally overall that he enjoys playing. So I'm hoping that he looks back on those thoughts in the past and you know, towards the future. But I mean, Shapovalov is playing in form at the moment. He's had a lot of grass. He played at Queens. He played at Stuttgart. He was also fresh from a walkover, so he didn't have a second round match to play after Andujar withdrew after that long, long match with Herbert on Tuesday, which my auntie watched all the way through on court five or whatever court it was out there. So, you know, obviously, Shapovalov had a lot of time to prepare and rest his body ahead of that match, which Murray perhaps hadn't had so much of. So I kind of expected Shapovalov to win that match. Perhaps not quite the thumping that he had. Yeah. And he perhaps, yeah, could have done a bit, little bit more. I don't know. But I feel that was the right level for Andy to go out of this tournament when you look at it on paper at the start of the tournament.
Yeah, it was funny because the match really pivoted, I think, on, you know, the business end of the first set. I think when it was kind of like, you know, Shapovalov was, I think, 5-1 up, and then Murray broke back and he was trying to break back again. And that for me was the moment, where, you know, you felt like Murray needed to win that first set. And as soon as he didn't, it sort of, I think, snowballed from there, really. But I mean, Shapovalov, I mean, he hit 45 winners, 13 aces. His serve looked, I mean, we talk a lot about his single-handed backhand, which is an absolute delight. But his serving was just, it was just phenomenal. And even when the roof came on, it helped Shapovalov and his serve even more. And I think what was kind of most, you know, worrying, I think, you know, in that match as it kind of progressed was the fact that, you know, Shapovalov and his second serve, he was really going for it. He was finding the lines. And, you know, even Murray is one of the, you know, one of the best returners in the game, just was not able to get a look in, even on Shapovalov's second serve. And that, and as a result, he was just finding it very, very hard to, you know, break him down. And Shapovalov played the break points very well as well. He saved 8 of 9. Yeah, it was a very, you know, very, very good performance. He gave a very classy interview as well afterwards, I thought, you know, saying that, you know, Murray's legend and he's already looked up to him. And this match was very much a dream, kind of dream come true for him. So, you know, although I'm a bit sad about Murray, I'm quite happy for Shapovalov because I did think he needed a statement win. I think this is an Andy Murray that is not the Andy Murray of, you know, a few years ago, I certainly think it was a standout performance that again will set him up well going into the second week with a match that, Lee, I'm just going to say now, feels like it's got 5 sets written all over it against the semi-finalists from 2019, Roberto Bautista Agut.
Yeah, I think that might be an interesting one and a tough one for both of them. I feel like Shapovalov has matured over the last few years, and he's showing that now. He looks more grown up as a person. He's got chest hair now, which he didn't have 3 years ago. Because I found some pictures of him from 2018, and he looks like a baby, like with the long hair. I think he's you know, it always made me laugh when on the BBC, John Lloyd talked about, you know, his when he looks at the players, and he always picks out Shapovalov as a future Grand Slam champion. And in my head, I've always been not quite sure about that, John. But actually, now I think, you know, potentially he may be right, and he may have been right all this time. So, I look forward to seeing a lot more of Shapovalov in the future. I think he's got some good things coming. Just going back to Andy, I wondered what your thoughts on his future. I touched on where do you think his limit is on this comeback?
Yeah. I mean, it's the $1 million question, isn't it? As you said, he was, I think, quite downbeat in his press conference afterwards. You know, he was talking about you know the fact that he's kind of put, you know, everything into the last kind of 3 months, and all he's got to show for it is a third round at Wimbledon. And I think he was looking at it very much glass half empty. You know, if this is the best I can do, what's the point in carry on, was essentially the sentiment that he was kind of conveying. But I think that was more for me kind of sort of a knee-jerk, I hope anyway, was a knee-jerk reaction to a pretty crushing defeat. I think, you know, with more time to reflect, I think he'll realize actually the fact that he's done that with, you know, only 3 months kind of work, being hampered by, you know, a groin injury that, you know, not even doctors could kind of figure out. I think that was a pretty, you know, pretty kind of impressive showing. And, you know, you look at him versus, you know, Nick Kyrgios, for example. Both players had very little match practice going into a Wimbledon, and it was Nick Kyrgios whose body kind of shut down on him. It wasn't Andy, you know, it wasn't Andy Murray's. That's not the issue. I think the question obviously is that he wants to compete. He wants to be back on the tour. He's obviously going to need to get his ranking up. He's not going to be able to rely on wild cards forever, but he's going to need to find a way with his team, you know, to work and understand the best sort of training schedule that enables him to play in, week out, because he can't, it's going to be pointless if he's just going to get frustrated with himself. I think if he's just going to have these stop start, you know, moments where yes, he can play one tournament here, get a wild card there, but then have to stop. And he doesn't want that. I think if it gets to that sort of situation, then I think we're going to have to sadly be looking at, you know, the future post tennis. But I think certainly at the moment, given the way he has played, should give him some encouragement. Given the way his body has played, should give him some encouragement. And, you know, the fact that he got to the third round, yes, that will boost his ranking. And I'm hoping that he can get to a point where he can be more, I think, self-sufficient on the ATP tour, not just sort of relying on, well, I don't think he's not going to be able to rely on wild cards forever.
No, and I think the move to the hard courts is only going to be tougher on his body as well. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how far he can go in the Olympics and whether he plays anything then before the US Open. I don't know, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Let's talk about Dan Evans against Sebastian Korda. The other match on centre that day involving a Brit. Korda came through 6-3, 3-6, 6-3, 6-4 against Dan Evans. I mean, on paper, a bit of an upset. You know, Evans is the 21st seed. But I think tennis fans know Korda as a player who, I mean, at 20 years old, American, he showed, you know, his family, you know, his DNA. He's just, you know, a very, very, very big prospect, I think, for the future. And I think what was so remarkable about that match was, you know, going beyond, you know, his serve and saving lots of break points, it was his composure. It really felt that when he was on court, he just was not fazed by anything. He wasn't fazed by Dan Evans. He wasn't fazed by British crowd. And, you know, he would have never been in that situation before. The fact that he was on center against a British hope, he just seemed to revel in it. And he just never seemed flustered. Even when he lost that second set, he had a swagger and a confidence about him that, you know, you just felt that he knew, you know, deep down he was going to be able to get the job done.
I think Korda has been very impressive this week. Before the draw happened, I probably wouldn't have picked out Korda to beat Evans, but after I saw him beat Alex de Minaur on Tuesday, I was at the end of that match on court 17 and was really impressed with how Korda had played. So I knew he was like a dangerous opponent. So I was expecting that to be a tough one for Dan Evans. I think Evans, by his own admission, probably didn't quite play as good as he could have done. But then he often says that after a loss, and I don't think we should read too much into it. So he does, you know, he does put a downer on himself and he does berate himself after a loss quite well, rather than sort of think and analyze it as much as some other players do. So, yeah, disappointing for Dan Evans. But like you say, it's on paper, it's an upset. But was it really an upset? I think
you could. Yeah. If you look at the play, if you looked at the level of tennis that they brought, I think, yeah, Korda just had an answer to most of the questions that Dan Evans was throwing at him. So, you know, very, very, very impressive there. Now, if, you know, for him, I think, you know, for Korda now, everything is a bonus. So let's see how he goes. Just one other match, I think, to talk about. You know, on the men's side from that day, we had Novak Djokovic against Dennis Kudla, came through in straight sets. Very fun match. I mean, it very easily could have gone to four. Kudla was up in that tiebreak in the third. I think he was up a break as well in that third. So Novak Djokovic did very well to kind of come through that in straights. Bit of an interesting, you know, bit of an interesting quote afterwards about his match, talking about wolf energy, saying, "I spent a lot of time in the mountains with wolves, so this is a wolf energy." What was that about?
Do you know what? I don't try to understand what goes on in the mind of Novak Djokovic. It sounds like a very scary place. but it kind of, if it kind of explains, I think for me, some of the behavior that we see from Djokovic on the court. You know, if you look back at the semi-final at Roland Garros, where he let out that proper good roar at the end, which kind of took everyone by surprise.
Very primal. Yeah. Maybe that's where the wolf energy started.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, trying to understand the things that go on in Novak Djokovic's head is not somewhere that I would want to go to. So, but yeah, I don't know. I was trying to understand, because I did hear the quote, but I'm not sure what the questioning that led to that answer was.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was bizarre.
But wasn't it John Inverdale that was asking the questions? And it was, John Inverdale has a knack for asking some bizarre questions as well. So, yeah.
who knows? I mean, we also had, as I said, I already kind of mentioned, we had Roberto Bautista go through against Dominic Kupfer. Had quite a nasty fall earlier on in that match. So I'm glad he was able to get up and come through that. Rublev is just progressing through the draw, looked quite good against Fornini. Christian Garin, who is defying all my sort of expectations of him as just a serial clay courter.
Yes.
Is through to the second week. So that's been quite you know, impressive for him, living up to his seeding, I think. And then Fucsovics taking out Schwartzman. Again, yes, upset on paper, but not totally surprising. But yeah, Kachanov as well against TFO. TFO obviously taking out Tsitsipas early on in the competition. So some very good victories there. But let's move on to the women's side, because, Lee, we need to talk about the match. Arguably one of the matches of the tournament so far, Garbiñe Muguruza versus Ons Jabeur. Ons Jabeur winning 5-7, 6-3, 6-2, 2 hours, 25 minutes. She threw up along the way as well. And although I think Muguruza saved what felt like a million break points along the way, it just wasn't enough. And Jabeur, who started really tentatively, really nervously, was just grew in confidence through the match, and Muguruza by the end of it just did not have an answer to the variety that Jabeur brings to a tennis court.
No, I've been really impressed with Ons Jabeur recently. I watched her play. I watched the final in Birmingham here. And I've been really impressed with her. And I watched her first round match at Wimbledon as well. Yeah, really, really impressive with Ons Jabeur. I think she's got a huge, great future. You know, she plays really well. She's really just, she's just there and doing she's the right there. Things. and it's going to be really tough for anyone that she comes across to, have the right answers to beat her. So
she plays with so much belief, I think.
Yes.
And, you know, she talked about, yes, you know, she's embracing, I think, being this role model in the, you know, the Arab world and to women. And, you know, I don't think she necessarily was expecting it. You know, I think, you know, kind of reading between the lines in interviews, she's embracing it. And I think she's embracing it really, really well, really, really positively. She's almost seeing it as like a challenge. And yeah, to get a win against Muguruza, who I was saying was playing some of the best tennis, I thought, in the first kind of couple of rounds, you know, to come through was very good. I mean, we had Świątek as well. Again, another player who is becoming very, very a dab hand, really, you know, at multiple surfaces. She came through against Begu in just 55 minutes. It was, again, another match that was just very, 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 very emphatic. Who knows what is going to happen with Świątek. I mean, that is going to be definitely a player to watch in the second week. Another player also who had a storming victory was Sabalenka, who had that, you know, had that topsy-turvy match against Bulta, came up against Colombian qualifier Maria Camila Osorio Serrano, beat her love in three. Sabalenka, I mean, I keep wanting to call you Kim. I'm sorry, Lee.
It's all right. That's what you're used to. It's fine.
I mean, we were talking about before coming on air for the podcast. You've got your eye on Sabalenka. You think that, you know, do you think Wimbledon is this going to be a time that she's going to finally break through?
I think for me, if you take the number one seed Barty and you take the number two seed Sabalenka, to me, Sabalenka is the one that I favour over those two to win it. Whether they meet in the final or not, I'm not sure. I think they probably will meet in the final. But I think Sabalenka, she's just going along, doing her thing. She's very much made a statement that she's there, but she's not attracting a huge amount of attention. Because she's playing matches that you expect her to win at the moment. I think what will really sort of show her is when she comes up against a player that is a more of a test for her. I mean, I don't think Osorio Serrano was a particular test for her. You know, so I think when she comes across a player that is going to be a big test for her, that will then showcase. I mean, she's got Rybakina on court three on Monday. So that again is not going to be a showcase of her talents to a wide audience.
And it's just getting through it, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but I think when she gets to the end of the week, I think that will surprise some people and they'll see she's had a really decent run through the tournament. And that's my tip for the win.
But we also had Samsonova as well extend her winning streak to 10 matches. She took out Sloane Stephens, which for me was a little bit of an upset. I know that Samsonova is in good form at the moment. But yeah, she came through against Sloane Stephens 6-2, 2-6, 6-4. Again, very, very impressive. Also, another wild card. I mean, the wild card picks have been, I think, very, very... They've done very well with their wild cards. They've not been, I think, wasted on players that, you know, got out in the first round or whatever. We're seeing, you know, with Raducanu and Samsonova.
There's been a few, but there's been some standout ones, which has been good and a good use of the wild cards, definitely.
And we have Madison Keys as well, who, again, I think a player that not really many people have been talking about, and obviously not a Grand Slam champion, but someone who's been to, I think, the semi-finals at Wimbledon. Has she been to the semi-finals at Wimbledon before? Or quarter-finals? Anyway, she is, again, a player, I think, has announced herself with that win against Elise Mertens in straight sets, 5-3. Back into the fourth round, first time since 2016. Sorry, she got to the quarterfinals in 2015. So again, another player who seems to be maybe a little bit like Angie Kerber, just kind of peaking at the right time.
Yeah, definitely. I think Keys is doing well, so will be interesting to see what happens going forwards.
Before we kind of look at Manic Monday and all the glorious, the feast of round four matches we have, let's quickly talk about Nick Kyrgios and Venus Williams, mixed doubles. I mean, they beat Austin Krajicek and Sabrina Santa Maria 6-3, 3-6, 7-5. I mean, Santa Maria, they should have, I don't know how this match ended 7-5 in the third. Her serve, I mean, 5'2", they should have been breaking that serve at will in my head. But anyway, it was such a fun match, wasn't it? Just to see two legends of the game. One legend in his own right, let's say, play with each other. I mean, that was just such a fun encounter, wasn't it?
It was fun. It reminded me a little bit of the, you know, the Andy Murray Serena Williams partnership of a couple of years ago. Getting, you know, big names that are not necessarily double specialists, but in there to play it and have a bit of fun and kind of put a show on for the ticket holders. I don't think that, I mean, they haven't pulled out of the next round yet, but I would be surprised if Kyrgios doesn't pull out of the next round given his injury in singles. I think that's probably a given, but there's been some fun pairings in the mixed doubles, because the one that stood out to me in the draw sheet was Naomi Brody and Jeremy Shardy partnering, and interesting, they won their first round and then they got a walkover into the second round because there were no alternates that signed in. I think anyone who has been able to sign in and play mixed doubles has been able to, and they've ran out of people now to sign in on the mixed doubles. So that was a bit interesting. We had a similar situation in the women's doubles with Krejcikova and Siniakova. They've had like a double walkover into the third round because there weren't any alternates to take their first round spot, and then their second round opponents withdrew. So I don't think there's been any real surprises in the women's doubles. But in the men's, we've already lost Murray and Suarez, and we've lost the Skupski brothers. We've lost Herbert and Mahu because Herbert had to retire injured after the first set. So that was in an all-French battle with Shardy and Martin on the other side. So there's a couple of surprise losses on the men's side, but the women's draw seems to be going as expected, really.
And looking forward to Monday, Manic Monday, as always. We've got a lot of, well, all the round four matches in the singles across the men and women's draws. I mean, we've not got long left, but where would you be heading if you were there? I mean, you've got Center, you've got Djokovic, Garin, Goff, Kerber, Federer, Sonego. I mean, the women's match there for me is probably the highlight, Goff, Kerber. I feel like Djokovic, Garin, Federer, Sonego, those feel relatively straightforward. Ogier Aliassime versus Zverev, that could be quite fun. And then Raducanu, Tomjanovic on court one at the end of the day. Again, big test for, big test for both of them. Tomjanovic now, as I said, a player who has had issues closing matches. You know, she might be in that situation again. Who knows? But that's going to be a fascinating encounter as well.
I think where I would go is court number two for Świątek versus Jabeur. I think that has the potential to develop into a rivalry going forward. They played in Washington in 2019 and Świątek won that one. I think Jabeur might just have the edge this time, being on grass and the form that she's had. We'll have to see. It's interesting. And then following that, Marton Fucsovics and Andrei
the
Rublev.
The rivalry that keeps on giving.
Yeah, part five. of just this year, because they'd played before as well. I mean, Rublev has won the four matches that they've played this year, would have been five, but for the walkover in Doha. It'd be interesting to see if Martin has anything this time against Rublev. I suspect that it was going to go Andre's way once again. The other interesting one you mentioned, Auger Aliassime versus Zverev. Zverev has won every match that they've played so far over the three times. So I think that's going to be the case again.
I've, I've noticed that the tournament organisers, after Corda beat Dan Evans, has gone from centre court all the way out to court 18 for his match against Karen Khachanov.
There's nothing wrong with court 18. It's a nice court. It's a lovely court. I would be quite happy to have a ticket for court 18 on Monday as well. I you know, any of those courts. I think for me, court number two is the pick. I centre court seems to be, in terms of the men's matches, Djokovic and Federer, those seem to be quite easy matches for those to win. So I think they'd be quite one-sided. I think that will be, you know, done three sets, both of those early. I think Goff and Kerber, a little bit different, but it'd be interesting.
And Lee, just before we finish, we've got to say this is the last middle Sunday that is going to happen with no play at Wimbledon from next year. There will be play on this day. And I mean, are you emotional about it? I'm not. I think it's the right decision. You know, it's a weekend. This is when, you know, fans can watch tennis. So for me, it's just something that, yeah, it might have been a tradition that has lasted for decades, and maybe some people see it as part of the Wimbledon fabric, the Wimbledon DNA, but quite honestly, as a fan, I want to watch as much tennis as possible, and if they're not playing tennis on a Sunday, they need to rectify it. So I'm glad they have done that.
Yeah, it also means the end of Manic Monday, which, I mean, to be honest, every day up in the first week, if you're trying to follow it like we do, are all manic, really. You know, Friday, 11 o'clock, we had 8 matches starting at the same time because they scheduled them all at the same time, the singles matches. I mean, you know, try and follow 8 matches all at the same time is ridiculous. But yeah, so Manic Monday will be the end of that also. But actually, I think that's probably a good thing, spreading those fourth round matches across the Sunday and the Monday gives you know, an opportunity for fans to see more tennis. I won't lie, I do quite like having the rest in the middle of a Grand Slam just to relax and calm down and catch up on life.
Absolutely not. I want it fast and furious. But
it's not the end of the world. And obviously it makes commercial sense for them to do it as well, because that's an extra day they can sell tickets, an extra day that they can get fans in, an extra day that TV companies around the world can sell advertising around the matches. So it absolutely makes commercial sense to do it. All the other Grand Slams do it. I think Roland Garros starts on a Sunday and has another day. I think that's more about court assignments and things, making sure that they can get every first round match played within 3 days. I think they struggle with two. So, it absolutely makes sense. I think it's been coming for a while. It's just, someone had to sort of sign on the dotted line and say, yes, make it happen.
Yes, and yes, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this round three, round by round catch up with The Passing Shot. Lee, it's been a pleasure, as always, to have you on the show.
That's quite all right. Anytime. Next time you go on holiday and I'll do it with Kim.
Well, exactly. I don't take holidays, so, you know, of course. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of The Passing Shot. Remember to stay up to date on all things Wimbledon by subscribing to us on your podcasting platform of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castbox, Stitcher. You can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. And if you have been enjoying listening to the show on Apple Podcasts and you want to help the show out, make sure to leave us a rating and comment.
You can follow the Passing Shot podcast on Twitter at Passing Shot Pod and on Instagram. And you can also email the show at passingshotpod@gmail.com. I think I've got that right, Joel.
Yes, that's completely correct. You passed the test. yes, we will be back. We're going to be back Monday. We're going to be back tomorrow evening, recapping all of Manic Monday. I will be back with Kim. Kim is back from her holiday. So I hope you can join us for our round four, round by round catch up on Monday evening. And we will see you again soon.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.